pistol, takes aim, and shoots the dog in the forehead. It collapses to the floor, and the echo fades away. She smiles at them through cracked lips, then staggers backwards when someone tugs on the metal wire round her waist. "We saw an SOS signal," Adam says. "I'm smart, aren't I?" she says wearily. She starts to move back along the passageway, and the metal wire pulling her clatters against the walls and floor. "How many of you are there down here?" Adam asks as they follow her. They step over the dog and the pool of dark blood spreading out across the floor. "Where are you going?" She doesn't answer, and they carry on round a corner. Further along the dimly lit passageway is a faint light. They pass an open storeroom, and in the gloom they can see a mattress on the floor, boxes, some old skis, and stacks of tinned food. Someone tugs harder on the wire, and the young woman keeps stumbling on, opens the next door, and staggers into the storeroom. Light shines out onto the door opposite, and her shadow sways across the corrugated metal and smooth walls. There's a growing stench of rotting rubbish. Yuna and Adam follow her with their pistols pointed at the floor. The light is coming from a pocket torch hanging from the ceiling, illuminating the nearest part of the large storeroom. Among a mass of removal crates and picture frames stands an emaciated man, dressed in an unbuttoned mink coat. It's Philip Cronstedt. Yuna and Adam raise their guns. He's filthy and has white froth at the corners of his mouth. His bare chest is covered with blood from a patchwork of cuts. The first woman they saw, the one in the worn padded jacket, is sitting on a box in front of him, eating mushrooms from a jar with her fingers. Philip hasn't seen them yet. He's carefully winding the retracted wire round a huge spindle, then scratches his neck and pulls the woman in the checkered shirt closer without looking up. "Philip," she whispers.
"I need you on guard, Sophia. I don't want to have to lock you up, but I've told you before, you can only have the light on when the door is closed."
"Philip Cronstedt," Adam says in a loud voice. Chapter 45. Philip Cronstedt looks up and stares at Adam with tired eyes and dilated pupils.
"I'm the hat maker," he says quietly.
Sweat is running down Yuna's back, and he can't hold his pistol up any longer. The torch hanging from the ceiling sways in a gust of air, and the shadows slide around the walls, its light reflecting off a large floor mirror. Yuna moves to one side, blinks, and sees in the mirror that there's a knife sticking out of the box in front of Philip.
"We need to talk to you,"
Adam says, moving forward cautiously.
"How many videos are you in every day?" Philip asks, staring at the floor. "Where does it all go? What decisions does it lead to?"
"We can talk about that if you let the girls go."
"I don't give a shit about Snowden and optic nerves," he says slowly, pointing at the ceiling.
"Just let the girls go and..."
"This isn't Prism or X-key score or Echelon," he interrupts in a louder voice. "This is a fuck of a lot bigger than that."
Yuna puts his pistol back in its holster and walks slowly towards the woman whose name is evidently Sophia. He can feel the last of his strength draining away, the way icy water makes everything sluggish but scorchingly sleepy. Philip's hand is getting closer to the knife sticking out of the box. Sophia falters, and the wire rattles softly.
"Saturn ate his children," Philip goes on, then sniggers. "I mean, the NSA is much bigger, and we're their children."
Yuna just manages to see him put his hand on the knife before his vision flares again and he has to lean his own hand against the wall to stop himself falling. Little dots are still floating before his eyes as he starts to loosen the coarse wire around Sophia's waist. He has to rest his forehead against her shoulder for a while before going on. He can hear her shallow breathing. Without showing any sign of outward anxiety, he unwinds the wire some 20 revolutions before she's free.
"Are there more of you down here?"
he asks in a subdued voice as he leads her out of the storeroom.
"Just me and my sister," she replies.
"We are going to get you out. What's your sister's name?"
"Carola."
The metal wire unravels on the cement floor with a scraping sound. Philip tugs at the knife, making the side of the box bulge out before he loses his grip.
"We're here now, but who ends up in Guantanamo? You don't know, do you?"
he says, without looking at them.
"Carola," Yuna says in a normal tone of voice, "could you come over here, please?"
Sophia's sister puts the lid back on the jar of mushrooms and shakes her head without looking up.
"Carola, come to me,"
Sophia says. She sits there, picking at the jar as Philip looks at her and scratches his neck.
"Come on,"
Yuna says, feeling his gun rub against his chest.
"Eugene is with them, you know. GCHQ, the NSA, same thing. I've been so badly fucking deceived for years. Everyone's naked. Everyone's having fun. But how can you protect yourself if you're completely naked? If everyone can film you from the fucking back?"
The torch spins round and dark shadows cross their faces and shoulders.
"Sophia wants you to come over here," Yuna says.
Carola looks up and smiles at her sister. Sophia brushes the tears from her cheeks and holds out her hand.
"Can we go home now?"
Carola whispers and stands up at last. She's about to start walking when Philip grabs hold of her hair and pulls her back, tugs the knife from the box and holds it to her throat.
"Hang on, hang on, take it easy now," Adam calls. "Look, I'm putting my gun down." "Go to hell!"
Philip screams and sticks the knife into his forehead before putting it to Carola's throat again.
"Do something,"
Sophia whimpers. Blood from the wound in Philip's forehead trickles through one eyebrow and drips down onto his cheek.
"I know you're only trying to protect her,"
Yuna says calmly.
"Yes, but you—"
"Listen to me," Adam interrupts, breathing quickly.
"You need to put the knife down."
Sophia is sobbing with her hand over her mouth. Philip looks at Adam and grins at him.
"I know where you're from," he says,
and presses the knife harder against Carola's neck.
"Put the knife down, now!"
Adam shouts, moving sideways to get a clear line of fire. Philip watches Adam and licks his lips nervously. The room is gloomy, but blood is clearly running down the blade.
"Philip, you're hurting her,"
Yuna says, trying to conquer his dizziness.
"You don't have to do that. We're no threat to you."
"Shut up!"
"We're just here to—"
"Shut up!"
"We're here to ask about Maria Carlson,"
Yuna concludes.
"Maria? My Maria?" he says in a low voice. "Why?"
Yuna nods and thinks that he could shoot Philip in the shoulder, disarm him, and then lie down on the floor. He's waited too long. He can hardly see anything now through the burning pain behind his eyes.
"Look, I'm taking my gun out and giving it to you,"
Yuna says, carefully drawing his Colt. Philip stares at him with bloodshot eyes.
"Maria said the NSA have started creeping about in her garden," he explains. "I went over and saw for myself. A skinny man in yellow overalls,
like the Lofoten fisherman when I was little. He was filming her through the window, and
Yuna wipes some blood from his nose, and then his head explodes and his legs give way.
Sophia screams when he slumps onto his side, tries to get up, but falls onto his back and lies there with his eyelids quivering. She goes over to him and kneels down. A bubbling, pulsing sensation behind one eye makes him hold his breath. Before it goes completely dark, he feels her pull the pistol from his hand. She stands up, straightens her back, takes a few shallow, panting breaths, then aims the pistol at Philip.
"Let my sister go," she says sharply. "Just let her go."
"Put the gun down," Adam says in a shaky voice and moves between them. "I'm a police officer. You need to trust me."
"Get out of the way," she yells. "Philip's not going to let her go."
"Don't do anything silly," Adam says, holding out his hand.
"Don't touch me. I'll shoot."
She's clutching the pistol with both hands, but the barrel is still shaking. "Give me the gun," and there's a deafening explosion as the pistol goes off. The bullet grazes Adam's torso and hits Philip in the top of his arm. The knife falls to the floor, and Philip stares at Sophia in astonishment as blood seeps through his fingers.
"Get out of the way,"
she shouts again. Adam lurches to the side and feels warm blood pulsing out beneath his clothes. Sophia fires again and hits Philip right in the chest. Blood spatters the boxes behind him and runs across the glass of the mirror. The empty cartridge falls to the ground with a tinkling sound. Carola is still standing there with her head bowed and slowly raises her hand to her neck. Sophia lowers the gun and stares blankly at Philip, who slumps down and sits on the floor, leaning back against a box. He picks listlessly at the wound in his chest as blood pumps out, and his eyes flit about as he tries to say something.
Chapter 46.
On his way to his piano lesson, Eric stops at the ICA supermarket next to the Globe. He knows Madeline loves popcorn, so he's thinking of buying a few bags. As he walks through the shop, he catches sight of his former patient, Nestor, in the dairy section. The tall, slim man is dressed in pressed trousers and a knitted grey sweater over a white shirt. His thin, clean-shaven face and small head, with his white hair and side parting, look exactly the same as ever. Nestor has seen him and smiles in surprise, but Eric doesn't go over to talk to him, just waves from a distance and carries on through the shop. He picks up some popcorn and is on his way towards the checkout when he sees a popcorn machine on special offer. He knows he has a tendency to go over the top, but it doesn't weigh much and isn't particularly expensive. When he emerges into the car park with his bags of corn and the popcorn machine, he catches sight of Nestor again. The tall man is waiting at the crossing on his way towards the underground. He has 6 full bags of shopping by his sides. They're so heavy that he can only carry them a few meters at a time. Eric opens the boot of his car and puts the box inside. He's sure Nestor hasn't spotted him. The shy man is muttering to himself as he picks up the bags, shuffles a few meters, then puts them down again. Nestor is standing, blowing into his thin hands as Eric goes up to him.
"That looks heavy," he says.
"Eric? No, it's fine," Nestor smiles.
"Where do you live? I'll give you a lift."
"I don't want to be a nuisance," he whispers.
"You're not," Eric says, picking up 4 of the bags.
As Nestor gets in the car beside him, he repeats that he could have managed. Eric replies that he knows that and pulls out slowly from his parking space.
"Thanks for the coffee, but you shouldn't be buying things for me, Eric says.
You saved my life, Nestor replies quietly.
Eric recalls how Nestor's psychotic breakdown happened when his seriously ill dog had to be put down 3 years ago. When he was allocated to Eric as a patient, Eric had read the notes from the secure psychiatric unit where Nestor had been admitted. He used to talk to dead people, a grey lady who brushed dandruff from her hair, and a mean old man who twisted his arms in different directions. During Eric's conversations with him, it emerged that Nestor was fixated upon his dog's death. He talked a lot about the syringe being stuck in his right front paw and how the fluid was injected. The dog shook and urine spread across the bench as its muscles relaxed. He felt he had been tricked by the vet and the vet's wife. Nestor responded well to treatment, but when he tried to cut down his daily dose of Risperdal, he began hearing strange voices again. Eric was never sure if he had actually managed to hypnotize Nestor. He may have belonged to the small group who weren't receptive, but during those relaxed sessions in the dimly lit treatment room, they did at least begin to get to grips with things. Nestor had grown up with his mother, younger brother, and a black Labrador. When he was 7, his 5-year-old brother became seriously ill with a lung infection, which exacerbated his already bad asthma. The boy's mother told Nestor that his brother would die unless they had the dog put down. Nestor took the dog to Serdabician and drowned it in a trunk full of stones. But his brother died anyway. In Nestor's mind, the two events became intertwined. He had always suffered from the belief that he had drowned his brother in a trunk and had no memory of the dog. They worked on his anger with his mother's damaging manipulation, and after a month he finally let go of the idea of his own guilt and the notion that his mother could sometimes control his actions from beyond the grave. Nestor was living normally again now, didn't need to take any medication, and was incredibly grateful to Eric. They pass St. Mark's Church in Björkhagen and pull up outside Angsvallsvägen 53. Nestor unbuckles his seatbelt and Eric helps him carry his food to the door of his ground floor flat. "Thanks for everything," the former patient says in a tremulous voice. "I've got ice cream and time to..." "I need to get going," Eric says. "But I have to offer you something," Nestor says, opening the door. "Nestor, I've got an appointment." "Walk across the dead without a sound. Walk across the dead and hear their murmuring resound." "I haven't got time for riddles now," Eric says, and walks out of the door of the building. "Promise," Nestor calls after him. Chapter 47. Jackie and Madeleine are sitting together on the sofa, eating popcorn, while Eric tries to play his etude. Madeleine says he's very good every time he makes a mistake. She's tired, and her yawns are getting bigger and bigger. Jackie tries to explain the quaver rests and the rhythmic pattern, and gets up and puts her right hand on top of his. She asks him to start from the 22nd bar with his left hand, then she suddenly falls silent, goes back to her daughter, and listens to her breathing. "Could you manage to carry her to bed?" she asks. "My elbow isn't up to it." Eric gets up from the piano and picks the child up. Jackie walks ahead of them, opens the door to the girl's room, turns the light out, and pulls the covers back for Eric. Eric carefully lays Madeleine down on her bed and brushes the hair from her face. Jackie tucks her daughter in and kisses her on the cheek, whispers something in her ear,
and turns on the little pink nightlight on the bedside table. Only now does Eric see that the walls of the child's bedroom are covered in rude words, curses, and obscenities. Some of the words are written in childish scribble, in chalk, misspelled, whereas others are written in more confident handwriting. Eric presumes Madeleine must have been doing this for several years. Her mother is the only person unable to see what she's done. "What is it?" Jackie says, noticing his silence. "Nothing," he says, closing the door gently behind him. As they walk through the hall, Eric wonders if he should tell Jackie about what he saw, or just let it go. "Should I leave?" Eric asks. "I don't know," Jackie replies. She holds out her hands and feels his face, stroking his cheeks and chin. "I'm just going to get some water," she says hoarsely, then goes into the kitchen and opens a cupboard. He helps her, standing close to her, filling the glass and passing it to her. She drinks, and then he kisses her cool mouth before she has time to wipe her chin. They embrace. She stands on tiptoe, and they kiss each other deeply, foreheads bumping together. Eric's hands slide over her back and hips. The fabric of her skirt has a peculiar texture and rustles like thin paper. She pulls away slightly, turns her face, and puts one hand on his chest. "We don't have to," he says to her. She shakes her head and puts her hand behind his neck again, pulls him to her, kisses his neck, fumbles with the buttons of his trousers, then stops herself. "Are the curtains closed?" she whispers. "Yes." She goes to the door and listens for any sound in the corridor, then closes it carefully. "Maybe we shouldn't do this here, not now." "Okay," he says. She stands with her back to the draining board, one hand on the counter, her mouth half open. "Can you see me?" she asks, taking her dark glasses off. "Yes," Eric replies. Her clothes are disordered, her blouse hanging outside her skirt, and her short hair is rather messed up. "Sorry, I'm being difficult." "There's no rush," Eric mumbles, and walks up to her, takes hold of her shoulders, and kisses her again. "Let's take our clothes off, shall we?" she whispers. They get undressed in the kitchen, and Jackie starts talking slowly about a radio report she heard about the persecution of Christians in Iraq. "Now France is offering asylum to all of them," she smiles. He unbuttons his trousers and looks at her as she lays item after item on the chair and undoes her bra. Completely naked, Eric goes and stands beside her, thinking that he feels oddly natural. He doesn't even try to hold his stomach in. Jackie's teeth glisten in the faint light as she pulls her underpants down, wriggles her legs, and lets them fall. "I'm not a shy person," she says quietly. Her nipples are pale brown, and in the darkness she looks luminous. A marbled tracery of veins is faintly visible beneath her pale skin. Her dark pubic hair makes her inner thighs look fragile. Eric takes her outstretched hand and kisses her. She backs into the chair and sits down. He leans forward, kisses her on the lips again, then kneels down and kisses her breasts and stomach. He pulls her carefully to the edge of the chair and parts her legs. Her folded clothes fall to the floor. She's already wet and tastes of warm sugar to Eric. Her thighs quiver against his cheeks, and her breathing grows heavier. The salt cellar topples over on the table and rolls in a semicircle. She holds his head between her legs, gasping faster, The chair slides backwards, and she slips gently onto the floor with a smile.
"I'm not sure I'm any good at relationships," she says, resting the back of her head uncomfortably against the seat of the chair. "I'm just a pupil," he whispers.
She rolls over onto her stomach and starts to crawl under the table. He follows her and grabs hold of her behind just as she rolls onto her back. She pulls him gently to her between her thighs, hears him hit his head on the table, and feels the heat of his bare skin against hers. Jackie holds his back hard and gasps for breath as he slowly slides into her, and then pauses.
"Don't stop," she whispers.
Her heart is pounding, and the torrent of thoughts has finally fallen silent. She moves her hips, presses herself towards him, and feels the silky heat from her crotch. The hard floor disappears behind her. Her thighs tremble and stretch, and Eric moves faster. She tenses her buttocks and toes and whimpers against his shoulder as her orgasm pulsates through her body. Eric wakes up in the darkness to the sound of gentle piano music. It sounds strangely muted, like a piano buried under the ground. At first he thinks he's dreaming. He reaches out his hand but can't feel Jackie. Moonlight filters through the fabric of the curtains, casting strange long shadows across the room. With a shiver, he creeps out of bed and into the flat. Jackie is sitting naked on the piano stool in the living room. She's placed a thin blanket over the piano to muffle the sound. Through the gloom, he sees her body swaying gently. Her hands seem to be slipping through water. Her bare feet move over the brass pedals. She is sitting on the edge of the stool, and he can see her slender waist and the shadowy groove down the center of her upright back. "Nam etsi ambulo vero in medio umbrae mortis," she murmurs to herself. He thinks she knows that he's there, but she still plays to the end of the piece before turning towards him.
"The neighbors have complained," she says quietly, "but I need to learn a fairly hard piece for a wedding tomorrow."
It sounded wonderful.
"Go back to bed," she whispers.
He returns to the bed and is just about to fall asleep when he finds himself thinking of Björn Kern. The police still don't know that the dead woman was sitting with her hand to her ear. The thought snaps Eric awake when he realizes that he could be hindering the police investigation. After an hour, the music falls silent and Jackie comes back to the bedroom. It's already light outside by the time he falls asleep again. In the morning, the bed is empty. Eric goes to the bathroom, showers, then gets dressed. When he emerges, he can hear Jackie and Madeleine in the kitchen. He walks in and gets a cup of coffee. Madeleine is eating breakfast cereal with milk and fresh raspberries. Jackie explains that she has to be in Adolf Frederick Church in a little while to rehearse for the wedding. As soon as she leaves the kitchen to get changed, Madeleine puts her spoon down and turns towards Eric.
"Mum says you carried me to bed," she says.
"She asked me to help her."
"Was it dark in my room?"
she asks, looking at him with bottomless eyes.
"I haven't said anything to your mum. That would be better coming from you."
The girl shakes her head and tears start to run down her cheeks.
"It's not as bad as you think," Eric says.
"Mum will be really sad,"
she hiccups. "It'll be all right."
"I don't know why I have to ruin everything,"
she sobs.
"You don't."
"Yes, I do. I can't get rid of that,"
she says, wiping her cheeks.
"I did far worse things."
"No,"
she sobs.
"Maddie, it's not a problem. Listen now," he says.
Why don't you and I paint your walls? Can you do that?
Yes.
She looks at him with a trembling chin and nods several times.
What colour would you like?
Blue. Blue, like Mum's nightie.
She smiles. Is that light blue?
What are you talking about?
Jackie asks. She's standing in the doorway, already dressed in her black skirt and jacket, a pale pink blouse, round sunglasses, and pink lipstick.
Maddie thinks it's time to repaint her room, and I said I'd be happy to help.
Okay,
Jackie says, with a slightly bemused expression. Chapter 48. Margot sees Adam waiting for her in the underground garage of police headquarters. His T-shirt is bulging because of the bandage round his chest. She walks towards him, but has to stop when the baby pushes upwards. The plastic-covered trestle tables are covered with objects seized from Philip Cronstedt's storeroom, lined up and numbered, ready for analysis. Another colleague approaches from the other direction. She hears him say something appreciative to Adam, then he carries on towards the lifts. Adam's weary face, with its dark shadow of stubble, looks brittle in the harsh lighting. Behind him, she can see that the work of cataloguing the vast amount of material seized is proceeding. On the first table lies a gilded bedhead, a wooden crate containing starched folded linen, battered books, and three pairs of trainers.
How are you feeling?
Margot asks when she reaches Adam.
It's nothing, he replies, putting his hand to his ribs. My mind's spinning, though. I keep seeing it all, and thinking that I would have been dead if she'd angled the gun just a tiny bit more, 3 millimeters to the left.
You should never have gone down there without backup.
I made the decision that we had to go in, but I don't think I really appreciated the state Yuna was in. He collapsed on the floor and dropped his gun.
He shouldn't have been there anyway.
It was a fuck-up, he nods. There's going to be an internal inquiry, obviously, seeing as I was shot, but it will probably end up with the National Police-related Crimes Unit. So we'll need to talk that through.
Margot looks at a faded school poster of the female anatomy. The eyes have been coloured in with blue chalk.
But without Yuna, we'd never have caught Philip, she says. I caught Philip. I was the one who did that. Yuna was lying on the floor.
The harsh glare from the fluorescent lights and magnifying lamps reflects off the plastic between the objects on the tables. Margot stops beside 3 video cameras with crushed lenses wrapped in ESD-proof packaging in a spacious cardboard box.
Is anyone trying to match Philip's cameras with the videos of the victims? She asks. I presume so. But you haven't found the tongue stud or the rest of the deer?
Give it time, Adam smiles.
This is just the material from the storeroom. There's no rush.
The important thing is that it's over, that we've got him. They pass a pile of hand-painted tin soldiers, and Margot can't help thinking that the rest of the little porcelain deer and the Saturn stud ought to be here, given that Philip was living in the storage facility at the time of the murders.
How sure are we that it's him? She asks. Philip's in the operating theatre at the Karolinska, but as soon as he can talk, we'll get a confession out of him.
Have you got anyone on guard there? She asks.
He was shot in the chest. One lung is wrecked, so I hardly think that's necessary.
Do it anyway. There are about 20 Polaroid photographs of young women with bare chests in a small plastic folder.
If it'll calm you down, I'll sort it out as soon as I get upstairs, Adam replies.
I spoke to Yuna in the hospital, and he seems to think that Philip didn't commit the murders, and
what the fuck? Adam interrupts with an irritated smile. I let Yuna come with me because I felt sorry for him. That was a mistake. I'm not going to repeat. We can't let him play at being a detective.
I agree, she says quickly.
He messed up, and he's not coming anywhere near this investigation again.
I'm just trying to say that this feels too easy,
Margot says calmly, carrying on along the tables. Philip was on the point of confessing when he was shot. He said he'd been creeping about outside Maria Carlson's windows, Adam says, turning to her with a grin. He's got no alibi for the evenings of the murders. He's extremely violent, paranoid, and completely obsessed with cameras and surveillance.
I know, but he'd locked himself away with two women.
You should have been there. He had them tied up with steel wire.
Even though he is hollow-eyed and clearly short of sleep, there's an underlying fire in his eyes, and his cheeks are flushed.
Adam stops and catches his breath, leans his knuckles on the nearest table for a while with his eyes closed. The stress and exertions of the night come back to hit him like a heavy pendulum. He thinks about the ringing in his ears after the last shot, as blood trickled down his side and under the waist of his jeans, before he managed to disarm one of the sisters. He thinks of the huge dog that tried to rip him apart, and the orgy in the Birger Jarl Hotel, the unprotected sex with an unknown woman.
Tears well up in his eyes as he thinks about how little control he has, how little he knows about himself. He suddenly feels an intense desire to go home to his wife, to curl up in his warm bed behind Katrina, to the smell of her hand cream and her ugly bed socks and the liver spots on her back that look almost like the plough.
Margot walks past an old-fashioned gramophone and stops in front of some jewelry on a piece of cardboard. She gets out a pen and pokes through the tarnished silver rings, brooches, broken chains and crucifixes. She picks up a heart-shaped charm with her pen, just as her mobile rings. Margot lets the heart fall back onto the cardboard, pulls out her phone, and answers by giving her surname. Something in her voice makes Adam turn towards her. Margot will always remember this moment, the way they were standing in the bright light among Philip's possessions, and how her heartbeat drowned out absolutely everything else for a few moments.
What is it? Adam says.
She stares at him. She can't talk, her throat is so dry, and she realizes that her jaw is trembling.
A film, she hisses. We've received another film.
Fuck, Adam swears and starts running towards the lifts. Call the hospital, Margot gasps as they hurry past the tables towards the lifts. Check if Phillips escaped.
Adam presses the lift button, then clutches his phone to his ear as she catches up with him. The machinery rumbles slowly. She's moved too quickly and her pelvis is burning. Adam holds the phone to his ear and shakes his head in her direction.
Has he gone? She gasps.
No answer, he says anxiously. The lift stops two floors up, and Margot presses the button again, whispering angry curses to herself. Finally, someone picks up at the hospital. A sluggish voice tells Adam that he's reached the intensive care unit.
My name is Adam Youssef. I'm a detective with the National Criminal Investigation Department, and I need to know if one of your patients, Philip Kronstedt, is still with you.
Philip Kronstedt, the man at the other end says.
Listen, you have to listen, Adam pleads and realizes how incoherent he sounds. I want you to go and see him and check that he's there.
The man sighs as though he were indulging some sort of ridiculous whim, but Adam hears him put the phone down on his desk and walk away.
He's gone to check, Adam tells Margot. Make sure they confirm his identity, she says, as the lift doors close behind them. They shuffle about like caged animals as they're sucked up inside the building. Adam's shoulder crumples a poster advertising a concert by the police choir. Philip Kronstedt is still sedated,
the slow voice finally tells Adam.
Philip's sedated, Adam repeats.
Chapter 49. Adam runs down the corridor ahead of Margot. Philip Kronstedt was given emergency sedation when he was brought into A&E early that morning and has been kept like that ever since. The real serial killer is still on the loose. Margot follows Adam into their office and sees the treetops of Kronaberger Park in the pale sunlight through the small windows.
Have we got a copy?
It looks like it, he replies.
Margot is gasping for breath as she sinks onto the second chair in front of the computer, while Adam clicks the video file. The base of her spine is stinging, and she leans back, her shirt pulling up over her bulging stomach.
The film has been online for 2 minutes, he whispers and starts the media player.
The camera is moving quickly through the outer fringes of a bird cherry. The leaves obscure the view for a moment, then a bedroom window appears on the screen with condensation along the bottom. The garden is shady, but the white sky shimmers in the windowsill. The camera moves backwards again when a woman dressed in her underwear comes into the room. She hangs a white towel with old hair dye stains over the back of a chair, then stops and leans one hand against the wall.
1 minute left, Adam says.
The room fills with soft light from the lamp in the ceiling. They can make out fingerprints on the mirror and a slightly tilted framed poster from the Picasso exhibition at Moderna Museet. The camera moves to one side, and now they can both see a reddish-brown porcelain deer on the bedside table.
The deer, Margot pants, leaning towards the screen as her plait falls over her shoulder.
The snapped deer's head that Susanna Kern was clutching in her hand must have come from an ornament exactly like that one. The woman in the bedroom is holding one hand to her mouth and walks slowly over to the bedside table, opens the drawer, and takes something out of it. Her face is more visible in the glow of the bedside lamp. She has pale eyebrows and a straight nose, but her eyes are hidden behind the reflection in her dark-framed glasses, and her mouth is relaxed. Her bra is red and worn, and her underpants white, with some sort of sanitary pad. She rubs something over one of her thighs, and then takes out a small white stick and presses it to her muscle.
"What's she doing?" Adam asks.
"That's an insulin injection." The woman holds a swab against her thigh and screws her eyes shut for a moment, then opens them again. She leans forward to put the syringe back in the drawer and manages to catch the little deer, knocking it over. Small fragments fly up in the sharp lighting as the head snaps off and falls to the floor.
"What the hell is this?" Adam whispers.
With a weary look on her face, the woman bends over and picks up the porcelain head, puts it on the bedside table, then goes round the bed towards the steamed-up window. Something makes her stop and peer out, searching the darkness beyond. The camera moves slowly backwards, and some leaves brush over the lens. The woman looks worried. She puts out her hand, takes hold of the cord of the blinds, and loosens the catch by tugging it to the side. The slats slide down, but end up crooked, and she pulls the cord and lets them fall again, then gives up. Through the damaged blinds, she can be seen turning back towards the room and scratching her right buttock before the film suddenly comes to an end.
"Okay, I'm a bit tired," Adam says in an unsteady voice and stands up. "But this is crazy, isn't it?"
"So what do we do? Watch the film again?" Her phone buzzes on the desk. Margot turns it over and sees that it's one of the forensics team.
"What have you got?" Margot says as soon as she answers.
"Same thing. Impossible to trace either the film or the link."
"So, we're waiting for someone to find the body," Margot says, and ends the call.
"She's maybe 1.70 meters tall, weighs less than 60 kilos, Adam says. "Her hair is probably dark blonde when it's dry."
"She's got type 1 diabetes, went to see the Picasso exhibition last autumn, single, regularly colors her hair," Margot adds in a monotone.
"Broken blinds," Adam says, printing out a large color picture where the whole of the woman's face is illuminated. He goes over to the wall and pins the photograph up as high as he can. A solitary picture, no name, no location.
"Victim number 3, he says weakly.
To the left of the photograph are pictures of the first two victims, stills taken from the YouTube clips. The difference is that below those two first pictures are names and photographs of the murder scenes, as well as reports from the forensic analysis of the scenes and the postmortems. Maria Carlson and Susanna Kern. Multiple stab and knife wounds to their faces, necks and chests, severing their aortas, lungs and hearts. Chapter 50. Sandra Lundgren leaves the bedroom and feels a shiver run down her spine as if someone were watching her from behind. She tightens the belt of her dressing gown, which is so long it reaches the floor. Her medication leaves her feeling drowsy long into the day. She goes into the kitchen, opens the fridge, and takes out the remains of the chocolate cake and puts it on the worktop. She adjusts her glasses, and her dressing gown falls open again, uncovering her stomach and sagging underwear. She shivers, pulls the wide-bladed knife from the block, cuts a small slice of cake, and puts it in her mouth, without bothering to get a spoon. She's started using Stefan's striped dressing gown, even though it actually makes her feel sad. But she likes the way it weighs upon her breasts, its drooping shoulders, the threads hanging off the sleeves. Beside the candle holder on the drop-leaf table is the letter from Södertörn University College. She looks at it again, even though she's already read it 30 times. She's on the reserve list for creative writing. Her mum helped her fill in the application. Back then, she didn't feel up to doing it herself, but her mother knew how much it would mean to her to be accepted onto the course. She cried in the spring when she was told she hadn't got a place. That was probably a bit of an overreaction. Nothing had really changed, after all. She would just carry on with her fourth term on the career counseling program instead. She doesn't know how long the letter had been lying there, among all the old post on the hall floor, but she's read it now, and it's sitting on the kitchen table. She decides to phone her mum and tell her the news. Sandra glances at the window and sees two men walking towards Winterwiegen on the other side of the road. She lives on the ground floor, but still hasn't got used to the fact that people sometimes stop and look right in through her windows. The wooden floor out in the hallway creaks. She thinks it sounds like a grown person trying to creep quietly. Sandra dials the number as she sits down on one of the kitchen chairs. She holds the phone to her ear as the call goes through, pinching the corner of the letter.
"Hi, Mum. It's me," she says. "Hello, darling. I was just going to call you. Have you thought any more about this evening?" "What? About coming over for a meal?" "Oh, yes. I don't think I feel up to it." "You still have to eat, you know. I could come and pick you up in the car. I'll give you a lift both ways."
Sandra suddenly hears something rustling and looks over towards the dark hallway and its clothes and shoes.
Will you let me do that, darling? Okay, she whispers, looking at the letter in her hand. What would you like? I don't know. Shall I do beef à la Reed Barrier? You usually like that, you know. Cubes of steak and... Okay, Mum, she interrupts, and goes into the bathroom. The blister pack of Prozac is on the edge of the basin. The green and white capsules shimmer in their plastic rows. Sandra looks at her own reflection in the mirror. The bathroom door is open behind her, and she can see right out into the hall. It looks like there's someone standing there. Her heart skips a beat, even though she knows it's only her black raincoat. The Three Musketeers went out for lunch today. Sandra leaves the bathroom while her mother tells her that she and her sisters went out to the Vaxholm Hotel and had fried Baltic herring with mashed potatoes and lingonberry jam, melted butter and nice, cold, low-alcohol beer. How is Marlin? Sandra asks. She's amazing, her mother replies. I don't know how she manages to be so positive the whole time. She's had her last session of radiotherapy and feels pretty good. It makes you glad you live in Sweden. She'd never have been able to pay for the treatment on her own. Isn't there anything else they can do now? Carolina thinks we should all move to Jamaica and sit around smoking cannabis and eating good food until the money runs out. I'll come with you, Sandra smiles. I'll let her know, her mum laughs. The phone feels warm and sticky against her cheek. Sandra moves it to her other ear and walks to the bedroom, but stops suddenly. She can't help staring at the window. The big bird cherry is moving through the broken blinds. I had a look at the list of course literature for your fourth term, her mum says. It's all about the politics of the job market. Yes, Sandra says weakly. She isn't sure why she doesn't just tell her mum about her place at Södertörn. Slowly, she forces herself to look away from the window and catches sight of herself in the mirror. Her dressing gown has fallen open again. She stands there in her underwear, looking at herself, her pale skin, rounded breasts, her smooth stomach, and the long pink scar across her right thigh. She and Stefan had rented a cottage in Åre over the Easter holiday. She was driving, and Stefan was asleep as they got close to Östersund. It was dark, and the box of skis on the roof was making a lot of noise. They had been stuck behind a timber truck for several kilometers through the black fir forest. The wide rear tires of the swaying trailer were churning up masses of snow from the edge of the road. In the end, she pulled out to the left to overtake, but saw the lights from an oncoming bus and pulled in again. After the bus, there were three cars, then nothing again. Sandra pulled out again and accelerated. They had just reached a long downward slope, and the timber truck was going faster. She sat beside the huge trailer, clutching the wheel with both hands, and felt the car lurch in the turbulence. Sandra accelerated a bit too hard to get past, and her wheels slid in the ridge of snow in the middle of the road. She lost control of the car and ended up underneath the timber truck. They got stuck and were dragged along, the metal screeching and shaking. She had blood in her eyes, but saw the huge wheels thud into the side of the car. The metal gave way and crumpled on top of Stefan. There was a whirlwind of glass, and the truck jackknifed as the driver braked, and the trailer lurched forward with a screech. She was alive, but Stefan was dead. She had seen the photographs and read what little had been reported about the evening when her life was thrown off course. "Are you taking your pills like you should?" her mum asks gently. And Sandra realizes that she must have stopped talking again. "Leave it, Mum. I can't talk now," she says. "But you'll come this evening," her mum says quickly, unable to conceal her concern. "I don't know," Sandra replies, sitting on the bed and screwing her eyes as tightly shut as she can.
It would be lovely if you did. I'll come and get you, and if you change your mind, I can take you back whenever you want.
We'll talk later on, Sandra says, and ends the call. She puts the phone down on the bedside table next to her blood sugar monitor. Outside the window, the verdant foliage of the bushes is swaying about. Sandra takes off the dressing gown and lays it on the bed, pulls on her jeans and opens the chest of drawers. The broken deer is lying beside the pile of neatly folded clothes. The funny thing is that the little head has disappeared. She takes off her glasses and pulls on a clean T-shirt. Once again, she feels like she's being watched and glances at the broken blinds, the shadowy garden, the leaves moving in the wind. She hears a thud from the hall and jumps. It's probably just more adverts, despite the sign on the door. She picks up the phone to call her mum back and apologize, and try to explain that she's actually happy, but that being happy dredges up a load of sadness too. She goes out into the kitchen again, looks at the letter on the table, and walks over to the worktop to cut herself another slice of cake. But the knife isn't there. She has time to think that her medication has made her confused, that she must have put the knife down in the bathroom or bedroom, when someone dressed in yellow comes towards her from the hall with long strides. Sandra just stands still. This can't be happening. She doesn't manage to say a word, just hold her left hand up to protect herself. The knife comes from above and hits her in the chest. Her legs collapse, and the knife is jerked out as she falls backwards and sits down hard on the floor. She hits her head against the table, dislodging the candle from its holder, and it rolls over the edge. Sandra feels hot blood pulsing down over her stomach. She has a terrible pain deep inside her chest. It feels like her heart is shaking. Sandra just sits there, unable to move, unable to understand, when she feels a blow to her head, then a terrible pain in her cheek. She falls backwards and loses consciousness. Everything becomes dark and warm. She can hear burbling water, then a burning pain in her lungs. She comes round and starts coughing up blood, stares up at the ceiling for a few seconds, feels the blade of the knife moving about inside her chest.